If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today. We're glad you're here. We're, of course, always taking your text messages at 312-981-7200. We got a big show for you today, and I'm sure you're cozied up inside somewhere because it's vaguely spring-like now, but it's cooling off pretty quickly as that winter weather blows in for us. So I hope you are cozied up and staying put wherever you are. You know, today we're going to talk about the Lumosity app. You know, the brain training app that we see advertised? We're going to be talking about that a little bit because they are in a little bit of hot water. We're also, of course, going to be talking about Brian Urlacher's hair and the Chicago-based company that helped him get it all back. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about Whole Foods, how they are expanding to a neighborhood on the South Side and the effort to do so and build community there. So we're going to be talking about lots of stuff today. But right now, we're joined by Doug Cameron from the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Doug. How are you?
Hi. Good afternoon, Amy.
Welcome to the show. Well, so the piece that you have on the Wall Street Journal on WSJ.com is all about the executive order issued by President Obama just recently and how gun sales responded to that and sort of a little bit of forecasting attached to that. But I think anecdotally, there was a lot going around about that. Certainly on social media, a lot of people were saying, now that this has happened, X has happened, and lots of conflicting information. So talk to us about exactly what we saw in the market after that announcement.
Well, I mean, you can actually back up 5-6 years to actually when President Obama was first elected. The fear, at least amongst many gun owners, actually has triggered a series of spikes and booms in gun sales ever since 2008. You can correlate the spikes pretty closely to some of the terrible gun-related tragedies. And the prospect of tighter regulation after that. So you've basically seen an industry which has boomed and busted and boomed and busted several times over the past 5 or 6 years. And this is the latest manifestation of this with the executive order and the planned tighter restrictions around gun control, which has basically created another surge in demand for guns and ammunition.
So it's really out of spite, one could say, really. So are we seeing this from, or do we have any data to suggest maybe this is people who already have guns, they're adding to their collections because they're fearful of what's coming? Or is this, or are we talking about new gun owners?
As ever, it's a mix of the two things. But one of the curiosities about this industry is actually the paucity of good data, and that actually extends to the gun manufacturers themselves. But what I can tell you is this, that the average handgun owner has something like 8 or 9 pistols in their collection. So there is a very large and very hardcore of, there's actually more sporting shooters, so people who do target shooting than actually hunters now. So you've seen a growth in popularity of on gun ranges, and the industry would tell you there's a younger demographic, more women taking part. So that's one half of it. But by far the largest part of the market is what you might call personal protection, is driven by the fear factor. So you're seeing a mix of people adding to those, you know, collections of 8 or 9 handguns already, and some new ones coming into the market, partly because of personal protection, but also they're taking part in shooting sports, largely indoor and outdoor gun ranges. So it's new and existing owners.
Mm-hmm. And do we see generally that when any kind of executive order or any even just kind of conversation politically about changing restrictions, when we see these surges, do they tend to stay up as a new normal, a new plateau of gun sale rates, or do we see it kind of dip back down after a short period?
Yeah, we've seen the ups and downs. So when they after the tragic shooting in Newtown in Connecticut, back at the tail end of 2013, you saw something like a 20-25% surge in sales, which lasted about 6 months. And then the manufacturers all cranked up production, and then demand fell off just as sharply, basically until, sadly, the next tragedy and the next, you know, political noise amongst about tougher restrictions. So it's been up and down and up and down, basically, for the not just the past 6 or 7 years. The industry's kind of done that for 20 years, but the spikes and troughs have just been that much sharper these past 6, 7, 8 years.
I find it really interesting that the market responds to shooting events similarly to the idea of coming political action. You would think, you know, the political action, I can understand how people react to that. But the, you know, seeing a shooting event seems so much, you know, it's so stark. It seems like that wouldn't fuel sales in the same way that political action would.
Well, I think you can see it in two parts. If you have both these domestic tragedies and also overseas events, such as what happened in Paris, you can see how psychologically that might trigger, mm-hmm. perhaps amongst new gun owners to actually, you know, make that decision to finally go out and buy. The other side of the coin is the prospect of tougher gun regulation. Of course, that hasn't really come to pass, despite, you know, we've had so many. There's been so much talk about it, it hasn't particularly come to pass. But what has come to pass is these people have gone out, bought guns, looked to buy ammo, and what they've found several times over the past few years is pure shortages. The shelves have been empty of ammo, even in something like a Walmart, which is, you know, the biggest retailer of consumer ammo. So a couple of years ago, you know, there was anecdotal talk of people literally, you know, fighting over boxes of ammo in the stores. So that's what's kind of driven those spikes that people rush out to basically stock up.
That is very interesting. And I got to wonder, too, about the manufacturers as they respond to higher demand, you know, not anticipating when that surge will start to die back down. I would have to wonder about how their returns and their quarters start looking on paper if they ramp up production and suddenly have a lot of surplus product around.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. They ramped up production and ended up with surplus with these previous troughs. But what's happening right now is they're producing everything they can. They're making as many handguns, as many rifles, and as much ammunition as they can, because what's traditionally happened in presidential election years, you've seen an increase, maybe not a surge, but in previous elections, you've certainly seen an increase in sales just because of the increased talk about more regulation, whoever wins, whichever side. So in expectation of a presidential election year, and because of what they've seen over the past 2 months, really, 3 months maybe, production has been increased. And they would rather take that risk of having some surplus and having to do a bit of discounting in the summer than have the shelves empty and lose out on the sales. So basically these factories are working 24/7 right now.
Hmm. Doug Cameron, Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for joining us today on the program to talk about this very complex and interesting issue.
Thanks for having us, Amy.
All right. Okay, my friends, we're going to take a little break when we come back. We're talking about Lumosity, the brain training app. They're in a little bit of trouble. So we're going to talk all about that when we get back on the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hope you're all having a good day. I know it's starting to cool off out there as the winter event is blowing into town. So I hope you're all cozied up wherever you are and you get to stay put through the worst of it. Thank you for tuning in. As always, we're taking your text messages, 312-981-7200. So my friends, you know those apps that claim you're going to get smarter, you're going to work your brain and kind of exercise those brain muscles, not that your brain's a muscle, but you know what I mean. You're going to work that neural passageways and you're going to get smarter and stave off mental decline as we age and all that. Well, you know, there's one of them, Lumosity, that we've, I think, all heard of. They have these darling little ads and very sprightly, fun, happy people that are doing lots of things and seem so smart and together. Well, Lumosity is in a bit of trouble because it seems like we have been led a bit astray and there's not quite the data to back up their claims that perhaps we thought. So joining us right now, we have Brian Fung, who's a reporter at Washington Post, who has written about this topic. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to us about Lumosity, because I admit when it first hit the market, they had a free trial and it seemed like a very good idea. And I downloaded it and I gave it a shot. But talk to us. Tell us about, you know, what's happened with them and how the events unfolded.
Yeah, well, you know, as you sort of alluded here, Lumosity has been pretty heavily advertised on everything from CNN to Fox News to Spotify and NPR. And so, you know, it clearly has a lot of cachet, a lot of, you know, people, it's clearly on the brain, no pun intended.
Right.
So you know, this is comes as a shock to many people. But you know, the federal government was looking into claims that Lumosity's product wasn't actually the Lumosity product wasn't actually backed up by real science, and so the company agreed to pay $2 million this week to settle those charges. And as part of that agreement, the company now has to actually include real science as part of its research and development and its marketing. So now, you know, what we're seeing here is essentially the federal government intervening on behalf of consumers who may have been misled by the advertising for Lumosity here.
And how did the cards sort of begin to fall on this? And was this a matter of consumer claim saying, you know, I don't think this is doing what it's supposed to, or was it something else that really triggered this investigation?
Well, the FTC generally goes after companies when it believes that they are engaging in unfair or deceptive practices, and oftentimes those come as a result of consumer watchdogs waving the red flag saying, hey, we think there's a problem here, and when that happens, the FTC generally opens up an inquiry and sometimes takes companies to court, and then those cases may or may not be resolved through a trial. Oftentimes what happened in this case is that, the government winds up settling with the company in question. When these things sort of happen, it's very rare to see an actual fine being imposed. What often happens is that there's a settlement, the government calls a consent decree that imposes some requirements on the company in question, and then if there's a further violation of that consent decree, then the company appears would be vulnerable to fines and other penalties. In this case, it appears as though the company settled for a certain amount of money, not necessarily in admittance of wrongdoing necessarily, but this is a settlement that is nonetheless a really important one for consumers who may have used Lumosity in the past or who were perhaps thinking about using it in the future.
And this really isn't the only app of its kind that has seen this sort of action from FTC. There's also, we've seen there was the one about detecting cancerous moles. There was the one about improving your vision that we've also heard kind of this pushback from them.
That's right. And, the FTC isn't the only agency that's involved in this space. When matters of health and safety are concerned, often the Federal Drug Administration, the Food and Drug Administration, is often involved in this as well. You may have heard of a company called 23andMe, which does genetic testing. Mm-hmm. That company was also under pressure from the federal government a while back because, it wasn't clear whether or not its product actually could tell you whether or not you were more susceptible to certain diseases genetically, relative to others. And so the FDA sent that product back to the drawing board and imposed a number of sanctions against it, saying, we don't necessarily trust what you're selling here. And so, you have a wave of these technologies, these companies offering products that, many consumers have been sort of convinced into relying on, being questioned by the federal government now.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I got to think from the company's point of view, if you are going to go out into the market and make a claim like we're going to boost your neuropsychological performance, we're going to help you improve your memory, that you'd have to have some data behind that for you to even believe that in the first place, hopefully, right? Hopefully. So does the parent company of Lumosity, have they indicated that they will be able to supply this kind of research? Or are they going to have to go take the product off the market for a while and then commission all of this research from scratch?
Well, Lumos Labs maintains that it engages in very rigorous testing, and basically the issue at stake here is that the evidence it was relying on was came from voluntary testimonials often and things like that were made it kind of tricky methodologically to make some of those claims as as well tested and rigorously as federal regulators might expect. So in this case, it's mostly a matter of tightening up the standards, making sure that the company is doing checking off all the boxes, making sure it's being as rigorous as possible and doing the studies and the research that it, claims to be doing. Ultimately, I think this the company, once it sort of turns a corner, it will probably come back on the market and sort of position itself to be, again, a strong service for people who are worried about cognitive decline.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And so there is a possibility of refunds being issued. And if someone is using this product and they are they have an automatic renewal on their credit card, because it does cost, I think it's about $15 a month, there is a process that will be coming, or maybe it's already available for people, for consumers to recoup some of their money.
Yeah, I mean, so the FTC is generally, is responsible for working with companies to offer consumer redress. Very often the FTC itself will set up a website where consumers can go to seek that redress.
Excellent. All right. Brian Fung, he's a reporter at Washington Post covering this and many, many other issues. Thanks so much for being with us today, Brian.
My pleasure.
Have a good one. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, we are talking about the company right here in Chicago that restored Brian Urlacher's hair. That's right. They're right here in town. So we're going to be talking all about that here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots to talk about in the business world today. And we're going to go a little bit long today. We borrowed an extra 15 minutes, so we're going to go till 1:15 today and get you up to that pregame. It's going to be all good. So lots and lots of business topics. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking with Samantha Baumkamp. She's a reporter at Chicago Tribune, all about new areas that Whole Foods is trying to expand to here in Chicago. But right now we have on the phone Danny Ecker. He's a reporter at Crain's. Hi, Danny. How are you?
Good, Amy. How are you?
Great. Welcome to the show. So we had this big reveal this week that I think social media's collective head exploded when suddenly we realized Brian Urlacher had hair.
I mean, it was an unbelievable publicity stunt. I mean, when you think about this guy, who's probably the most famous bald-headed Chicago celebrity there is and had been for so many years, and for him to pop up, on Twitter and all of a sudden, with this head of hair, it made national headlines. Somehow it was I guess it was lucky. Maybe there was no other big news that happened that day, I suppose. But
right.
Boy, it really took the sports world by storm.
Certainly. And it turns out that the company responsible for restoring his hair is based right here in the Chicago suburbs. It's in Oak Brook. It's called Katona. And they worked with him. And you wrote about this at ChicagoBusiness.com. And it's such an interesting story because there was so much care and detail paid to the PR end of this so that he would have this very big reveal, because it wasn't like an overnight process. It was like I think you wrote that it was about an 8 or 9 month process for him to regrow all of this hair. So in fact, you even note that he was shaving the hair as it was growing back, just so people wouldn't catch on to what he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty public guy. He's not on a weekly TV guy anymore like he was last year. He's doing a lot of it with Fox. He was doing some stuff on TV. He wasn't doing as much of that, but he's still pretty public. And, this guy, this company, actually, this doctor in Oak Brook, had been doing this procedure for like 15 years, but he kind of hooked up with a guy who kind of was going to try to throttle them forward with some marketing juice. And they partnered with some other Chicago sports celebrities and done this, but none, as big as Brian Urlacher. And, they really went to a pretty great effort to keep this under wraps, because as they were saying, it had to look good. That was the cue for them. It had to look good after, it had to be fully grown in, and it takes this process, this technology they use, I suppose, it takes a good 9 months for it to really look full, and they had to have it looking good, and most people, I think, even though it was a little bit weird to see him with hair, at least thought it looked not bad.
Well, you know what? I got to say, that morning I looked at social media, and the first picture I saw, it was on Instagram, and I didn't see the caption right away. And the first thing I saw, I was like, that guy looks like Brian Urlacher with hair. I mean, he looked so very different. It was a great reveal. I mean, there's nothing like having, a really popular celebrity a relatively well-liked one anyway, you know, especially local hero, using your product and having a really great result. But apparently the result was so great that it crashed their website. And it certainly, have you followed up with Dr. Katona and the team there about how it's been in the days since? I'm sure they're flooded with orders.
Yeah, you know, they said that they were basically, as you were saying to me, the guy, Jordan Sadoff, who's the president of the company, was saying that he really learned what it actually means to have your phones ringing off the hook that day. But haven't heard from them since. I think they're busy trying to deal with, you know, I think they'll still see it's a very expensive procedure, and I think they'll see whether they get a lot more business out of it. They certainly got a lot of media attention. I think that's what they were seeing, the other day. But he was a little bit bummed, I guess, that the site crashed because of all the attention. But I think that's hopefully they're able to seize this, I suppose. And this guy, Jordan Sadoff, he's actually the same guy who had that company a few years back. It's based out of Schaumburg called Goldmax. They were a cash for gold company that kind of cashed in during the Great Recession on buying gold, and it was something that he had just sort of, they had used Robin Leach, of course, for those commercials, as people may remember. So he's well versed in the high profile spokesman world, and he was able to kind of take this and get squeeze some good juice out of it.
Sure. Well, you mentioned the cost. What kind of costs would a customer be looking at if they were inspired by Urlacher and decided, you know what, I'm going to do that. I'm going to get that done. It's right here in town. You know, what kind of costs would they be looking at?
They said that, the prices range based on the number of relocated hair follicles as this technology works. But they said on average, one restoration will cost about $10,000. A little bit pricier than some of the, over-the-counter products you may find out there. But I suppose they stand by and are very confident in their product.
Yeah, apparently. Well, and they certainly have a great spokesman going for them right now. All right. Well, thank you very much, Danny Ecker. He writes for Cranes. You can find this story and others at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much, Danny. Have a great Saturday.
Thanks, and you too.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking with Tribune reporter Samantha Baumkamp about Whole Foods and new neighborhoods of Chicago that they are looking to get into. So we're going to look at all of that stuff when we come back. So stick around. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. You know, we're normally out at 1 o'clock, but we're going to take you right up to the pregame. So we're with you today until 1:15, talking about all kinds of business and technology topics that are burning holes in our pockets because they're important to talk about. We got to talk them all through. And one that's happening right now, we're joined now by Samantha Baumkamp. She's a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, just upstairs here at beautiful Tribune Tower. And she wrote a story recently that you can find at chicagotribune.com all about a new Whole Foods that's gone in Inglewood and a really interesting element of community building that's come along with it that I don't think have seen with any other Whole Foods in town. Talk to us about that, Samantha.
Right, indeed. Well, Whole Foods announced about a year ago that it was coming into the neighborhood with a fair amount of backlash. It's a store known for its well-heeled clientele, for catering to affluent individuals, and in a community like Inglewood, where the poverty level is near 50% and the average income is under $20,000 a year, it was really met with a fair amount of skepticism. So,
by the community or generally throughout the city?
Generally throughout the city, but also particularly in the community. You know, it is a food desert, and they don't have a lot of options. A lot of people are forced to take public transportation to and from, you know, even in the depths of winter to get groceries. But at the same time, they don't want a grocery store coming in that's going to charge high prices
that no one can afford to shop at.
Exactly.
Right.
So the thing I was most surprised about when attending community open house last week is that the community seems to have absolutely rallied around the idea. And Whole Foods, in turn, is focusing a lot on getting the community involved, both not only as shoppers in preparation for the opening in September, but also as local purveyors and suppliers of everything from soap to lasagna to greens. So it was a really interesting thing to see.
Interesting. So this was just about a week ago when we saw this big opening and this big event around it. And we see some of the community building sort of events happening. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, the Whole Foods on Ashland, there's like the classrooms, the one over by Clybourne and North Avenue. There's classrooms and there's stuff like that there. But this is like a whole new level of community involvement that's reaching into a lot of different areas.
Exactly. Whole Foods has done this. It's gone into low-income communities in other places in the country. It's gone to Jackson, Mississippi, New Orleans, Detroit. But nothing is quite as unique as Inglewood is going to be. So the effort to really get people involved, you know, even 9 months to 2 years out was really vital for the project.
And as we're seeing that, we're also seeing, you know, there's certainly a large number of jobs that go along with a store opening in any given area that people in the neighborhood can apply for, certainly. So we see that. We see a lot of, you know, economic benefit to this. What is kind of the plan going forward as the community is looking for all the opportunity here?
Well, the really exciting thing about that greeted people at the community open house on Wednesday night was that despite the fact that the Whole Foods in Inglewood on Halsted and 63rd doesn't open until September, people were still being encouraged to apply for other positions in the city open at Whole Foods markets around Chicago. So they can go start, you know, get employed as the second they're hired, start in a store, and then possibly work their way up a little bit in the next 9 months and go as a team leader or even a store manager when Inglewood opens.
Certainly. And it seems, too, that Whole Foods has always made some degree of effort to involve local makers. You know, we've often seen on the store shelves, locally made, they'll make the little placard there on the shelves. And it seems like there's a lot of people from that community there that has suddenly kind of jump-started interest in having their product in Whole Foods.
Absolutely. And you know, it's such a unique opportunity for people like the neighbors of Inglewood, because a lot of small business owners, you know, I was talking to a couple that didn't even have a website at the time, that literally came with two suitcases full of goods and said, you know, to the original community open house and said, I want to be in Whole Foods. What do I have to do? And Whole Foods works with these purveyors and works with these manufacturers to get their businesses up and running so they can set up to for success and to be in the Whole Foods later on.
Certainly. And talk to us a little bit more about some of the speakers that were at this event, because it certainly seems like there was a degree of kind of community organizing and civic level politics represented there.
Absolutely. I think the most special example of that was the MC, Cecile DeMillo. She was actually just a resident of Inglewood that came to the first community meeting about a year ago and spoke to and just asked questions about Whole Foods. You know, are you going to make it affordable? And asked the same questions that a lot of her neighbors wanted to know. And then when the community organizer, this kind of customer relations position came open, she was encouraged to apply. And now she's working for Whole Foods, going basically door to door, giving out flyers at train stations and encouraging her neighbors to participate in the market. So it's a really exciting kind of ground up approach.
And what was the Whole Foods response to that when asked about affordability? Because at the end of the day, you can build a great community around this. You can supply a lot of jobs, but still, if we're talking about a neighborhood that has, as you pointed out, a 50% poverty level, mm-hmm. you know, this is, we all know it's not cheap to shop at Whole Foods. So what was their answer to that?
I mean, they point to examples like especially Detroit, which is the closest example to Chicago. It's the store has been open for a couple of years, and it has about double the employees that the Inglewood store will have. But still, they've made every effort to make the produce and you know, everything that Whole Foods is known for, the organic options, et cetera, very affordable. Now, we shouldn't be confused. Whole Foods is not coming into Inglewood for some kind of community service project. Mm-hmm. It's about making a profit, and it expects to make a profit or it wouldn't go into Inglewood. But at the same time, it's coming in with its eyes open, and I think the community has its eyes open at this point as well, is that there is every effort is going to be made to make these products affordable, or people aren't going to shop there.
Mm-hmm, certainly not. And you bring up Detroit, and I think that's such an interesting example. I think that a lot of us followed very closely. You know, there was an organization led by Orrin Hesterman. He talked to us here on this station several years ago about the work he was doing, because he was there when this big first grocery store opened in Detroit. And I think we hear about food deserts, but I think Detroit was such a stark and interesting example of literally nothing but corner stores and bodegas. And he, I remember when interviewing him, he told a story about showing young children who had never had access to produce, really showing them a couple of examples, like a strawberry Fanta, a popsicle, or like a Pop-Tart or something, and then an actual strawberry, and asking them to describe what they were seeing. And none of them knew what the strawberry was, really. They kind of knew it in a cartoony way, but not in an actual produce sort of way. So there's, I think, a degree of education, too, of going into a you know, quote-unquote food desert, of you can't just dramatically shift you know, eating habits, buying habits, things like that, that there's, I think, some education about, you know, farming, growing, things like that, too. So I hope there's some community organizations, because I think that's what happened in Detroit. Detroit paired with, you know, teaching young kids about growing plants, growing food, things like that.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And, you know, it still remains to be seen. But Whole Foods, you know, is using the same model that's used in Detroit, that it's used in Newark, New Orleans, places like that, to come into Inglewood. It knows what it's up against. And also, you've got to give people in Inglewood a lot of credit. You know, in the last year or so, the community has really come along to understand what Whole Foods is bringing it. And I, for one, was really surprised at the amount of overwhelming support for the store. So I think, and then Whole Foods itself is really geared up to you know, meet that education and to really handle that education process head on.
It seems like
it opens.
That's been a big priority to them since the start of something they've always done a lot of. So what was that shift in opposition like in Inglewood? I mean, how did you know, originally an idea that was met with so much opposition of like, why are you doing this? Why are you putting the store here? This is not something that our residents can afford. Don't do this. To suddenly having overwhelming community support, possibly the best in the city. What was that shift like? How did the cards begin to fall there?
Well, I think it's actually a big factor in it is just the fact that the city gave Whole Foods, you know, around $10 million in incentives to come into Inglewood. It was coming. So the community, in a sense, you know, had no choice. But I think there was always this perhaps small sect in the beginning that said, hey, let's, you know, aldermen included, let's think about it. Let's appreciate the fact that Whole Foods in many ways is solving a huge problem for us. Communities, you know, around that area, neighbors won't have to take public transportation to grocery stores anymore, or they won't have to go try to find fresh produce in bodegas anymore, you know, or at least they'll have another option.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, once it was set that the grocery store was coming in, and then Whole Foods has, you know, made this huge effort to really educate the public about what it can bring, and that it's not just for those affluent, you know, North Side residents, I think that really shifted everything and changed a lot for the neighborhood.
Certainly. And I think that the city incentive is interesting, too. You know, the $10 million given by the city to bring Whole Foods there to incentivize them. Is that what we saw as Whole Foods entered Detroit and New Orleans and other communities where this same kind of formula worked so effectively?
Right. Yeah. It's Chicago gave more than Detroit, but it's still the same. It's the same thing. Whole Foods, you know, is a business looking to make a profit at the end of the day. It's looking to get a tax benefit in order to take a risk, because it is a risk. It's not its typical clientele.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Well, we kind of saw this with Starbucks, I feel like. You know, Starbucks kind of did a similar thing where they made a point to not just cater to clientele who could pay $5 for a cup of coffee every morning, but start to expand to other neighborhoods with pretty great result, really.
Exactly. And it's funny you mentioned Starbucks, because Starbucks is going in right next to the Whole Foods in Inglewood. So we really see a lot of companies, you know, not just doing it for the bottom dollar, but also making, hopefully making these neighborhoods better and safer and, you know, an easier time for these people to get groceries.
Definitely. That's super important. And who was the first, I mean, as we list these cities, who was the first city that we saw really do this effectively?
I would say it was Detroit.
Okay.
I mean, you know, we have examples in Newark and New Orleans, but Detroit was really the biggest example of how Whole Foods is moving into these neighborhoods, and it's also the most comparable to Chicago.
Definitely, and I think the most stark example, given, you know, the extreme situation in Detroit with at one point absolutely literally zero grocery stores at all outside of like corner stores and bodegas and that kind of thing.
Exactly. So I think it's fair to compare and look to them for what's going to happen in Inglewood.
Excellent. So what is the timeline again? Remind us, you said September is the opening for this store?
Yep, we're set for a September opening there, and the Starbucks is set to open soon after that, I believe.
All right. Well, we're all going to keep our eye on the excellent community effort, community building efforts going on there in Inglewood. And it's at, what did you say, 63rd and
West 63rd and Halsted.
And yep. Halsted. Okay. Well, there you go. We're all going to keep an eye on that. All right. Samantha Baumkamp from Chicago Tribune. She's a reporter there. You can check out this and all of her other stories at chicagotribune.com. Thanks so much for being with us today. All right, my friends. We're going to take a little break and get you to news and be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. We're going to go a little bit long here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, take you up to 1:15 for that Northwestern basketball pregame here on WGN. So we'll chat a little bit longer. You know, I want to talk about, there is a story on ChicagoBusiness.com that is all about three companies to watch in 2016, and they're all right here in our own backyard. One of them is McDonald's, and I think it is very interesting because I think we've come to believe certain things about our health and McDonald's and how they don't necessarily go well together. But newly appointed CEO Steve Easterbrook, he has said that he has vowed even that he wants to turn McDonald's into a, quote, modern progressive burger company. So it'll be very interesting to see how he goes about doing that. We've already seen a couple of changes hit the menu. I know there's been a little bit of talk of going to a more artisan kind of a little bit healthier option, things like that. So we'll see there. Another one is Walgreens, because what we saw is not content with just one merger, right? The CEO picked up another one because in October, Walgreens paid $9.4 billion for the rival drugstore chain Rite Aid, which brings the total to up to 13,000 stores in the U.S. alone. So that's going to be interesting to see what Walgreens does. But also United Continental, and that's one we saw a lot in headlines over the past year. We saw the CEO, Jeffrey Smysek, who resigned in September, and then we saw the new CEO, Oscar Munoz, come in and immediately have to take some medical leave after a heart issue, who has come back. So he's back and he's doing that. But they are, you know, they are, there's a lot to overcome there. There's a lot of reports of you know, glitches, lagging performance and you know, flight times, delays, customer dissatisfaction, employee relations, things like that. And we haven't even necessarily seen some great profit margins. But as he comes back, it looks like he's doing a lot of things to try to improve that. But, you know, that reminds me of a very interesting story that I read about another thing that was hit United recently. There is a 23-year-old who was working at a tech startup who created this product called SkipLagged. It is so interesting. Check this out. Go to skiplagged.com. He built this algorithm. He ended up getting sued, and it ended up being the best PR move ever. United sued him and Orbit sued him, asking for $75,000 in lost revenue. Because what SkipLagged does is that, you know, you have to get that connecting flight sometimes. You can't just fly to, say, Ithaca. You got to stop in Detroit or Philly or something, right? Sure. So what you do is you end up kind of getting that whole trip, but you only take the part you need. So say you need to get to Philly, you book your ticket to Ithaca, and then you just never get on that plane to Ithaca. You just stop at Philly. And that's what SkipLag does. It looks at where the connecting flight is. So if you're looking, so I was kind of playing with it the other night and just kind of looking, there's some unbelievable prices on there that it seems like it's too good to be true almost. I mean, there was one Chicago to New Orleans, I think it was like $40. Let's go now. that can change one's social life really quickly.
Let me check the weather and then
off
I'll
we
take
go.
You up on that.
I bet it's better than it is here. Let's go. You know, there was even some international flights. I mean, it was really affordable to fly to London and to Paris, and it was an interesting idea. I mean, what great PR he got out of being sued by United. And he's even said as much. He said, you know, it seems like that ended up being the best thing that ever happened, because and the Chicago judge did dismiss that case.
I know. Yeah. Well, it'd be a problem if they upheld it, I guess. But
they did not. They
he got off.
He got off. He's on it. And
well,
so
good for him.
Absolutely. I mean, he's 23 years old and he's already making headlines around the country, if not world, over this product that he's created. And I mean, it's a complicated algorithm just to as you play with it, you realize how much is in there and how much is, you know, powering this. And
yeah. Well, it must have been a preemptive lawsuit. I mean, they must have been worried about what he could do in the future, because when you say the number $75,000 in lost revenue for United Airlines,
doesn't it seem like much at all.
I mean, maybe I'm a little jaded. That seems pretty small in terms of their business and Orbitz. But they must have just been concerned about what it could be in the future and tried to put a stop to it early.
Probably, or in the very short amount of time that he's had the doors open,
yeah,
and the
exactly.
lights on, you know, they're maybe just looking at that number. I can see Orbitz being very concerned about that too, and those kind of like Kayak and those kind of places that will, you know, kind of pull together a flight itinerary for you based on the lowest prices. And this, I mean, as I was playing with it, I went and checked the same flights on other websites. I went both to the airline direct and their website and to Orbitz. And I think I also maybe looked at Kayak or Travelocity or something. Unbelievably different prices. I mean,
I'm sure.
I mean, there was, you could certainly cross the pond for a couple $100s. Which is mind-blowing to think about landing in London for $250 from taking off in Chicago. That's
no, not bad.
That's significant. So I think it'll be really interesting, because I think we've the supporters, and if you go and if you look at go to social media, especially Twitter, and just type in the word skip lag and see the things people are saying, it's really, really interesting. There was a lot of people that feel like they're kind of getting away with something. One guy even was calling himself an activist. He said, I feel like an activist by using the site, because I feel like I'm this kind of David and Goliath sort of moment going up against the big airlines and their baggage fees and all this stuff. My concern, though, is that one time I got stranded because of bad weather and ended up buying a one-way ticket home on a different airline. For months and months after that, every time I flew, it was very hard to get through TSA. You buy that one-way ticket, you know,
yeah,
and you kind of get flagged.
Yeah.
So I wonder, if you buy a ticket to, say, Ithaca, and you stop in Philly and you just never get on that plane to Ithaca, I have to wonder what that's going to do on your TSA. You know, I don't know if it's a rating or a score or whatever, but I'd have to think you might be flagged a little bit the next time you went through airport security.
Yeah. And is United going to start looking out for those flyers, too? And then
give them so much grief.
Give them a hard time.
Right.
No drinks.
Or maybe they'll levy some kind of cancellation fee or a fee if you don't get on the second leg or something like that. They'll probably find a way to fight back against it financially.
But then it's just continued bad press for them. It looks so bad. It is funny that someone would consider it as like an act of activism.
Oh, absolutely.
To get a great deal.
Isn't that funny?
That's the kind of low-grade activism I'm looking for always. Like, what's the least amount I can do? And in fact, save money.
Save
and
money.
And feel like a...
And get a really great trip out of it all in the process. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So it'll be interesting to see how that goes and how SkipLagged begins to or continues to go. And other startups that will get into that travel space, because I think there's a lot of opportunity there for creativity and for people to do very interesting things. And I'm sure that SkipLagged is just kind of opening the doors and scratching the surface.
It seems like a business that's so controlled by, you know, huge
regulation
money.
And big money.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I'm surprised that people are finding a way in, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely cool. Well, you know, it's always a matter of people when they feel like there's no option, that's when they tend to do sometimes the most creative stuff. Well, okay. So that we are running out of time. We're going to get the Oscar music here in a minute and get played off the stage.